From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just a year ago when the New York State election cycle was picking up. Cynthia Nixon was mounting a primary challenge to Governor Andrew Cuomo, and New York City Councilman Jumaane Williams was running for lieutenant governor. Among their proposals was a plan for statewide rent control, or as they put it, rent stabilization. Nixon and Williams lost, and housing rights advocates worried that this issue perhaps might once again recede into the background. But here comes City and State with a headline reading, New York is closer to universal rent control than you think. Why? Well, with Democrats taking all branches of state government, the push for rent policies has intensified. The Upstate Downstate Housing Alliance has put together a platform with seven planks for rent stabilization. They write, quote, we believe that housing is a human right, that all people should live without the fear of eviction, and that strengthening renters' rights is critical to strong neighborhoods, educational and health outcomes, and economic stability for all New Yorkers, end quote. They add that since 1994, New York State has lost nearly 300,000 units of affordable rent-stabilized housing. The New York State legislature could tackle rent control before the end of the session next month. But as economics writer Noah Smith points out, rent control is almost routinely dismissed as a bad idea by economists. Smith writes, quote, over the years, rent control has acquired a special boogeyman status among economists. Assar Lindbeck, a Swedish economist who chaired the Nobel Prize Committee for many years, once declared that rent control is the best way to destroy a city other than bombing it. End quote. Smith goes on to say that the unintended consequences of rent control are so severe that typically rents go up and housing stocks go down when rent control happens. So how would New York State approach rent stabilization? And what do advocates want to see? How do they see the issues here? Our guests have a lot to say as they discuss it this hour. Let's welcome them now. A couple of guests from the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. Ryan Acuff is back with us. Ryan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And Gail Force Williams, welcome. Nice to have you here for the first time.
Thank you for having me.
You got it. Kent Gardner is here, Chief Economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Kent, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, I want to start with Ryan and Gail, and what I want you to do is sort of outline how you see the problem that you want to solve here. When it comes to what's happening with tenants and the problem as you see it, how do you define it, Ryan?
Well, I think first I'd define it as an incredible scale of the housing crisis in Rochester, and that we can see this in there's over 8,600 evictions filed a year in Rochester City Court. That's not people, those are cases. One out of every four Rochester resident moves every year. So that's about 25% or almost 50,000 residents. So we're thinking about what's happening in our school district, what's happening with employment and stability, right? The numbers are staggering without our current protections. The level of instability, the number of people that are moving every year, the shortage of affordable, truly affordable housing for people living under the poverty line is, according to the low-income housing Institute Gap Report, is 28,000 units for people living at 30 AMI or living under the poverty line. So we're not talking about a couple people having trouble finding housing. We're talking about rents rising faster than incomes. We're talking about people, the majority of the tenants in the city, which is the majority of the residents, 60%, are rent burden, paying more than 30% of their income on rent. Many people paying more than 50% of their income on rent. So we're talking about massive instability, people paying too much for rent, people moving and really disrupting the fabric of our entire community through the school district, through health, mental health, how it affects our entire system, criminal justice, everything. And this is one of the foundations, which is this level of disruption that's happening.
Okay. Gail, how do you see it?
Well, I see it as history repeating itself, and it is a great problem, as Ryan suggested with some of the stats that he just presented. I just want to go back just a little bit, real quick. According to the 70s and early 80s, we went through this before, a series of changes that led to sharp rise in homelessness. Homelessness was no longer characterized by a down-and-out individual living on skid rows. For the first time in U.S. history, families were increasingly becoming homeless, and the shelter system was created to house them. And out of this common experience of dislocation, disposition, grew a national organization. But what really happened is that you have the middle class that become impoverished. So it sounds great starting out when we are doing all of this gentrification, because that's really what it is. But it eventually affect the middle class. So now it's affecting those that we consider low income, because it's very challenging for most New Yorkers, not just here in Rochester, but all over, to get in what we call an affordable housing situation. So we have a situation here, because if you repeat history and you think about housing and all of this as if it's just low income people, eventually it's going to affect the middle class at some point, and they themselves will find themselves homeless.
Kent Gardner, do you see the problem pretty well defined so far? Do you agree with what you've heard?
Absolutely. Housing instability is a horrible problem in our community and communities of poverty all across the country. And as Ryan points out, the impact on the city school district is dramatic, and you've got children moving from school to school. We know that the challenges the city school district faces and challenges those kids face, and particularly when they're moving from school to school with inconsistent curricula from school to school, it's an enormous problem.
Okay, and so now that we've got guests to agree on the problem, do you agree as an economist with Assar Lindbeck, who once said that rent control is the best way to destroy a city other than bombing it?
Is that
hyperbole?
It's maybe a little hyperbolic, but unfortunately what research shows is that rent control eventually reduces the total supply of housing. And the problem is the number of units. Yes, there are some landlords who are reaping rich rewards, but a lot of landlords, most landlords, I'd argue, probably are not. So as a consequence, if you restrict the rents without increasing the supply, we're eventually going to see rents rise.
All right, so what I want to do first with Kent is I want to identify, because there's different flavors of rent stabilization or control that have been tried in different ways, let's talk about how it typically kind of rolls out, and then from the economist's perspective, why most of your colleagues tend to view this as having unintended consequences or deleterious effects, even when they're well-intended. And then what I want to talk to Ryan Acuff and Gail Force-Williams about is, do you agree with that characterization, and do you see what New York State's doing as maybe finding a different form that can avoid some of those consequences? So typically in the past, can I start with one city and then we can kind of talk about this? Because I'm reading, and Kent knows a lot more about this than I do, but Noah Smith wrote a lot about the San Francisco study. So economists Rebecca Diamond, Timothy McQuaid, and Franklin Kian had a paper that looked at the effects of rent control in San Francisco, which is, of course, one of the cities in this country that is known for high housing costs. And a lot of studies aren't great in terms of sample size, or they're sort of patchy and incomplete. But Noah Smith writes, not this one. Diamond and her colleagues used data from a private company that was able to combine public records to track the addresses of all San Francisco residents between 1980 and 2016, even if they moved out of California. That allowed them to study the effects of a change in San Francisco's rent control policy that happened in 1995. Previously, all small multifamily buildings were exempt from rent control, but since 1995, only buildings built after 1980 are exempt. So here's what Noah Smith writes. How did this large increase in rent control affect renters? Predictably, people subject to the new policy became less likely to move, between 8 and 9% less likely, over the medium to long term. But not all renters benefited equally. The new policy created a powerful incentive for landlords either to convert rental units into condominiums or to demolish old buildings and build new ones. Either course forced existing tenants, especially young renters, to move. Landlords affected by the new 1995 policy tended to reduce rental unit supply by 15% on average. The author's model estimates that the 1995 rent control policy actually raised rents in San Francisco by 5.1%. So that's a pretty thorough study. And I want to know, I mean, how much do you think that that's either an outlier or is that the more typical course that we see?
Well, it's easier to track the numbers in a place like San Francisco, where you've got an acute housing shortage that's been going on for a long time. And I was chatting with a friend of mine, one of my colleagues at CGR, who is who moved here from San Francisco, and she says that looking for an apartment in San Francisco in the Bay Area is a full contact sport. that the goal is to get there first, make sure you can get to sign first, that you have absolutely every document you could possibly need so that you get to be the person who signs and walks away with that apartment. That is a it's a really serious problem, and it's a difficult one to deal with. But, you know, this particular study, because it was able to track movement, confirmed what economists have suspected, but, you know, we didn't really have the empirical data to prove that rent control is beneficial for a while for some people. And that, I guess, is the challenge. And when I'm talking with elected officials about this, I mean, rent control is a sugar high for legislators. Legislators can pass a law and say, gee, we fixed this problem, because it fixes the problem immediately. So they can say to their constituents, you know, I just passed this law, and it means that your rent may not go up next year, because the legislators have the power to do that. What they forget is that when we're 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, and we have throttled new construction, that people who are coming into that market either will find a deeply degraded housing stock, just because landlords will stop investing in those buildings, or will just find significantly higher rents in the parts of the market that aren't controlled. So, you know, it's like squeezing a balloon. If you don't allow an increase in supply, you're going to drive up prices someplace else.
Okay. Ryan, does that concern you, or do you think that New York can kind of learn from that and craft it in a way that's going to help?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you talked about the details of the San Francisco study, because it definitely supports rent control in a very strong way. So what the San Francisco study is showing is that people who are protected are more likely to have housing stability.
They don't move as often.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. The second thing is that if you have loopholes that incentivize people to destroy rent-stabilized housing, which we have in New York City and many other places, is that for-profit investors will take advantage of those loopholes, and they will reduce the supply of rent-stabilized housing, which we're seeing in New York City, San Francisco. You know, in San Francisco, it's condo conversions and these different ones. And in New York City, there's all sorts of other loopholes. So that's why it's important to protect, which the study shows, is it promotes housing stability to people that are protected. But with the loopholes that allow people to reduce those units. So that's the other thing. The second piece is, like you said, a sugar high is saying there's no one policy that addresses all issues. So that's one of these misnomers. Sometimes people say, well, guess what? Rent stabilization doesn't solve every single housing issues. No duh. There's no policy that solves every single housing issues. So you have to have policies that incentivize the creation of affordable housing. Now, if we talk about new construction, now we know that the cities that have rent stabilization or rent control, there's no shortage of new construction, right?
So that's actually not true.
So there's a
very significant shortage in new construction, and in every city that with significant rent control, that's demonstrable.
So I think New York City, San Francisco, and the study you talked about was all the demolishing buildings, constructing. So there's huge, huge amounts of new construction. The new construction is just not affordable housing, right? That's the problem we're seeing.
So, but ultimately, if the balloon doesn't get bigger one way or the other, you know, we still have this problem of restraining price on one end and then driving up rents other places. We have height restrictions in New York City. We have height restrictions in San Francisco. We have limitations on accessory apartments. We have limitations on accessory apartments here in Rochester. There are lots of ways in which we can increase supply at a more affordable level. Than simply regulating the price. And the one other thing I want to say is that you're right. I think one could argue a conversion as a loophole, but you know, people do own these properties and do have some rights. And the other issue is, I think that stopping, you know, that ceasing maintenance is not a loophole. It is a choice. The level of maintenance that a landlord can put into a property has a lot to do with how much money is coming in every month.
Yeah.
Okay. So hold on. So I think this is an important point here, because at least there's an agreement that when you look at San Francisco, when those landlords decided, okay, I feel incentivized to demolish, build condominiums or build something else, everyone's sort of agreeing that happened, and that if that continues to happen, these policies probably won't work the way you want them to.
Catastrophic.
So the question is, can you put something into the policy? Can you enact a law that's quote-unquote better or more effective that limits the ability to do that? Do you feel like the answer is yes, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And that's why in California they've legislated from the state level to block local cities from creating their own policies, because the immense popularity of this, and I think it's really important to say we're talking about property rights, is the question. It becomes a values issue at a certain point. Is our main goal the protection of property rights, or from our, because our perspective, the main goal is human rights, right? And then our property rights and our systems around property should be focusing that. And just like utility companies are regulated, housing can be, you know, there can be regulations that serve human rights, because I think this is where some people look at the same study and they interpret it completely differently, whether they're saying, well, is property rights the most important thing or human rights? And I think this is where our starting point is the human right to housing, and saying, well, how do we empty the shelters? How do we stabilize our neighborhoods? And how do we find the loopholes, even if for some people, a small minority, they're lucky enough to own multiple buildings, right? We're concerned about what about the majority of people that are struggling to actually live.
I do think that's a bit of a false dichotomy. I mean, the issue of property rights is it's one of law, and if we wish to acquire current multifamily dwellings, for example, and purchase them as a community with tax dollars, that's one of the options that's available to us. To the extent that we restrict the ability of someone who does have a right to manage his property, his or her property as they choose, to limit their ability to do that, at some point it does become an unconstitutional taking. But we can simply acquire the property, and that's one option. We can also purchase and build property as a public sector. So that's an option.
Okay. So, absolutely. All right. So let me ask Gail to respond to. I want to bring Gail back into the conversation. Here is a note from a listener who asked not to be identified.
Okay.
it's a name that some people may know, but just said, is housing a right? Rent control isn't just an issue for economists, and economists do hate it, but there are some moral issues here, and it's time to look at things differently. Do you feel that way, Gail?
Housing is a right, definitely. And one of the false perception is that we forget there's things that's called simple negotiation. It's one thing to forecast. It's another thing to deal in real time. And real time for Rochester, New York, is that the possibility 50,000 people have been compelled to move and move and move. And that's within a short period of time. So when we talk about rent control, we're literally saying, really, we're going to have to stop the bleeding. Meaning that these people moving, they increase homelessness, instability, mental health issues, educational problems in the school system, and genocide. And also, largely, it increased the crime rate, dysfunctional families, and community, which in turn place a strain on our economy. So I'm not buying the fact that the economists feel this or they feel that, because while we're feeling, people are being just numbers displaced. We're not even talking about homeless people on the street. We're talking about a middle class who's being impoverished, who's paying for all of this, by the way. And also, I understand that you have your private homeowners. I get it. One of the things that this law, the rent stabilization protection to the tenant, it's just placing a limit on how much and how often the landlords can raise rent. That's negotiable. So we're not saying, oh, let's just pass this rent stabilization bill and let's just put the landlord in a box. That's not the case. But it will help prevent gentrification, mass displacement, and stabilize a whole neighborhood. That is the issue. Now, we have these stats, but we have to deal with Rochester at this point. We have a lot of development going on. For example, if you go to one of the buildings, and I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, and I went there, and I was like, what would be considered market rent? Well, $1,400, even if you're on Section 8, a person getting subsidy, will be their lawyer's rent. And then you go to another building, you're talking about a two-bedroom with $2,100. I mean, where do we go from here? Where do we go? Because we're not necessarily having the financial, like the new money that flows from New York City. We're in Rochester. And I'm not really sure that the viewers really understand at what point do you pay for rent? $2,100 for a two-bedroom.
All right, so a couple of things here. I think what I want to do is make sure before we even continue, and we'll get to your phone calls, listeners, your emails as well. Got an email from a landlord. I've got some calls coming in, and we'll hit those. Ryan, can you just, because Gail's kind of touching on some of the specifics in terms of limiting how high rent can rise and how quickly. What are two or three of the big prongs as you see them right now?
Yeah, can I just talk about the two bills that are being debated for the next 22 days?
Sure, absolutely. Let's do that. And then what I want to do is ask, you know, people like Kent, because from his perspective and he and his colleagues, if they agree that the problem exists, are there other solutions or other remedies outside of rent control? But why don't you hit what's out there now?
Yeah, so there's basically a package of bills, two of them which really apply to upstate New York. So one of them is good cause eviction protections. So all this bill does is, landlord can choose to give a 30-day notice at any time for any reason for people living month to month, like we saw at the Cadillac, where everybody's mass evicted, given 30-day notices. Migs and Monroe, where the investor comes in, gives everybody 30, people live there 19 years, people live there 25 years. We got a call last week, 2017 East Main Street, right? Somebody buys it up, evicts everybody, no matter how long they live there, for their view of development. No matter how long someone's lived there, they didn't claim they didn't pay, they didn't claim they caused any issues. So what this bill would do would say, you can't evict someone without a cause, right? So you have to actually have a cause.
What's the example of a good cause?
Would be actual non-payment of rent, violation of the lease, violation of other tenants' rights, things that all of us, if I'm the owner, I want to move into my own unit, all things that most reasonable people would be considered reasonable. And into this bill is a protection against unconscionable rent increase, which is defined as a certain percentage, 1.5 times increases in the consumer price index or the cost of living. It's just a technical measure, but basically to say that there should be some protection. And all this is really is, it's not direct regulation, it's just a defense in court. Right. So it's to give some even playing field to prevent these tragedies where investors come in, they take people that have built the neighborhood, live there, and just because someone's got money, some people call that property rights or whatever, but some of money can drive out all the people from a neighborhood in a short period of time because of these laws that protect that. So this is one of the key bills. It has 56 sponsors in the Assembly, 25 in the Senate, is being debated. Gail and I and Mother of Rochester testified before the Senate housing hearing yesterday on these bills. So these are real bills that have a chance to pass this year in the next 23 days. The other bill is to allow for local cities, towns, and villages to have this debate we're having on the radio here to opt into this whole system of rent stabilization which exists in the downstate counties. And just so people know that this has been well litigated to the courts for a century, so it's completely legal. Landlords are under a rent stabilization system, are guaranteed a fair rate of return. If a landlord is not making a fair return on their investment, they can apply for an exemption. So every law protects landlords. Even rent stabilization law protects landlords' right to make profits and fair returns. What it all is doing is providing some balance for tenants to say, and what happens through these systems if we were to pass this law and the local city council or referendum were to pass in Rochester, it would create for certain larger buildings a rent guidelines board, which would say how much a rent increase could be for someone with a 1 year, 2 year lease based on the conditions, and they would take into account building costs and all these different things. But there would be a public process of input that would allow that, so you can't have a 20, 30, 40% rent increase and a whole neighborhood is cleansed of a certain class or color of people for the benefit of a few investors. Because, you know, when we see what happens, you follow the money, right? The people that have the most money are making certain decisions. And what this does is allows for a certain balance of power.
Okay. Kent Gardner, how do you feel about those proposals?
Well, I think the one thing I would object to is the notion that a tenant has a right to be in an apartment just as long as he or she chooses, which is the implication that they can only be evicted for for cause. I think that, you know, it really freezes the existing structure of a building, can freeze the structure of a neighborhood. And, you know, at the same time, I mean, I completely agree. Someone's been in a building for 15 years. To get 30 days to move, to find a new place and move out is really clearly unjust. So one of the adjustments might be to say instead of 30 days, perhaps they get 30 days for every year of tenancy. So, you know, if you've got a 15-year tenant, then they get 15 months of time. So, you know, not completely take away the ability of a new owner to change a building, to invest in the building and change the character of a building, but it would still protect tenants' rights, and particularly those longstanding tenants.
Okay. How do you feel about that, Ryan?
I would just say, have you ever had a no-fault eviction?
Well, that wasn't...
I'm just asking you personally, because I know Gail and I have both experienced that. I'm just asking if you've experienced that.
No, I haven't. But again, I'm just saying that I'm not saying that there would that. I mean, the notion of a no-fault eviction, which you were arguing, was that 30 days is too short a period of time. Right. So I'm just saying that if you're going to have that not allowing any evictions under any circumstances strikes me as very extreme. And if we were to change that of the rules governing evictions and giving some ability to change in a building rather than granting the tenant the permanent right to stay in that apartment as long as they keep their rent up and they don't disturb their neighbors, which is, I think, what you suggested.
Yeah, I mean, we do believe that tenants should have rights and people should have rights to live in stability. So I think it does become kind of a moral question. Are we protecting the rights of people who own multiple buildings? So people own buildings, usually homeowners, and own multiple buildings. Or are we protecting the rights of the people that have housing instability?
But again, it's not one or the other. I mean, there are rights on both sides. And you're arguing that the rights of the landlords are too strong right now. And I can understand that. And I appreciate that in many respects. But as soon as you say that you're going to eliminate the ability of a landlord to evict a tenant for anything other than cause, means that the tenant gets a right in that apartment as long as he or she chooses to remain. And that takes a significant right away from the owner. I'm just suggesting there should be a balance.
And the way it works on an everyday basis in the city of Rochester is tenants are living in, on most parts of the city, are living in slum conditions. And they are afraid to report their conditions because this is a negotiation that happens on a regular basis. They say, well, if you report this, I'll give you a 30-day notice. Right. So this is driving down the quality of housing in the city where people report to code. They'll form tenant associations. They'll speak up and they'll be evicted. But even more so is people who just are afraid to even report their issues, are afraid to even, because they know that the landlord holds all the cards and they know that they have this power because under this sort of absolute right of property ownership, like you're talking about, they can do what they want to do, regardless of the consequences of the people that affect it.
Well, it's not an absolute right of property ownership. Besides that, the city does do inspections, and I think that if we need to beef up the city's inspection regime to make it easier for tenants, I know that we do this, so we do a pretty good job with lead abatement, for example. You know, Rochester is recognized around the country as doing a pretty good job, better than most, in terms of dealing with problems with lead. We could increase that enforcement regime and make it easier for tenants to object on conditions. So there's a lot we can do.
Well, I would like to say, let me just give you a real quick personal. My family and I lived here for 5 years. We came here because I'm recovering from a traumatic brain injury. I received scholarship to Eastman School of Music and other places as well. We moved into a multi-family unit, and it was bought out. Well, before it was bought out, we literally called the code enforcement. I pulled the paperwork. They're supposed to be every 3 years doing this great inspection. Black mold, asbestos, no ventilation, people getting sick, proof of sick, dying, literally. My family had to move out because we had a no-fault eviction due to the fact that we reported black mold, asbestos. And let me finish, please. Here's the situation. We're talking about Rochester. And one of the things that are, that's so great about Rochester is the stability of the homeowners, and I get it. But I'm not sure if the homeowners know that when these carpet buyouts come in, they're paying tax dollars to give them a $1.5 million tax break. While some of the people who maybe live in a $500,000 house, for example, pay less taxes on that building. And that building is allowed, and I mean allowed, I have all the stats on if you want it later, to literally not renovate mode, black mode there is, not deal with anything. And they get a chance to evict. This one building took over 1 year. They have already put out about maybe 84 plus people. They have already done that. So my point is that we are talking about stabilization and we are talking about rent control. But what's happening, I really believe this. Rochester is a type of city. If I'm in Webster, what's in Webster, stay in Webster. If I'm somewhere, whatever. But what Rochester don't know, and the people that are out there that's living in these villages and wherever they living in their nice homes, that as they evict these people, they're sending these people who, like DHS and all these people, to their neighborhoods. Because they have no affordability pretty much at all in the city of Rochester at this point. That's proven numbers. 50,000 people, where are they going? They're going to Webster. They're going to all of these places that people who are homeowners going to begin to go like, who's in my backyard? That's kind of scary. So we're seeing, simple, the landlords in Rochester that we know have been given so much power to the point that tenants cannot even take them to court other than pretty much if, I guess, if you're not giving my, what do you call it, your deposit. But other than that, the tenants in Rochester absolutely have no rights.
Can we have a landlord who wants to respond to exactly what you're saying.
Thank
but what do you think should happen? This is Chris in Rochester who is a landlord. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, Evan. I you know, the issue that she's bringing up is really a inefficiency of the city code enforcement, if that's happening. I know in my particular case, I'm highly motivated to keep my place at minimum standard in order to satisfy the code inspections. But I also, you know, with in respect to rent control, every purchase or time I spend on my property is an evaluation of whether or not I can raise money to compensate myself for that purchase. So there's capitalism involved here with the shades. I don't just rent the building. I rent the paint, the floors, the fixtures. My decisions on a daily basis have to do with return on investment, but I also have to say that the tenant is my customer, and so I have to please the customer, and if the customer is not pleased and 25% of them are moving, then the landlord actually is bearing the cost of a vacancy. A turnover is expensive for a landlord, and a good businessman will know that a good stabilized tenant brings money by the very fact that they're in that apartment for a longer period of time.
But, Chris, what you're saying is Gail's problem should be handled by the city's inspection board?
Well, if she's complaining about landlords not taking care of hazardous conditions, that's certainly a city inspection problem. And if they're using illegal means to coerce tenants, then there should be a criminal justice ramification for that. But I have never had a tenant complain about something that you know, I wouldn't want to fix for example, the next tenant. And I have properties that make money in the city, mm-hmm. but if I were told that I couldn't make, you know, more than, you know, X amount of dollars, I may reconsider how I invest in my property on a daily basis.
Okay.
And I'm not alone.
Okay, so Chris, thanks. A couple of things there, and I'll let our guests respond here. And then I'm late for a break, and I guess we should have done both hours on this because there's a lot of feedback here.
Yeah.
What he's saying is, mm-hmm. In his own experience, and that's always the danger of the sample size of one, he can't imagine landlords doing this, but he also says if that's happening, there ought to be more powerful inspections. I don't know if that means more resources invested by the city of Rochester to inspect it and more protections for you. I mean, I think everybody's agreeing mm-hmm. that if you say there's black mold here and you get evicted for that,
right.
that's a problem.
Right.
But what do you make of how he frames, you know, his views on what happened to you as a landlord?
Sadly, there are there are people like him. I mean, not sadly there, but it's great that there are people like him. When we talk about corporate landlords, I'm not sure if you are aware, sir, that the corporate buyouts that's happening downtown. Now, it may not happen everywhere, but right now in the city of Rochester, definitely you will be like embraced, because you will be like, I'm sure, like a small percentage. But when we talk about these higher numbers, and trust me, we're dealing with the code enforcement. We're dealing with City Hall at this point. We're talking to the senators. We're talking to everybody that's willing to listen. You are perfect. But I wish we were in a perfect world. I really do. Then I would. Then we wouldn't have 8,600 people going to try to fight eviction. 20,000 families and 50,000 moving around in the city of Rochester. So I want to commend you. I really do. And I understand that, sadly, when we start playing with dollars, it is also sadly that, you know, we have these monopoly where we have the big corporate companies that come in and they make the little guys look bad, because you're doing great.
Yeah, and I think the landlords that are not just trying to make a profit but provide quality housing for their tenants are unaffected by these, by simple, basic tenant protections. I know when we had the housing hearing in May 10th in Rochester, it was historic that the Assembly called a housing hearing, that many landlords testified in favor of tenant protections. And actually, small landlords benefit from basic tenant protections because it allows for them to have an even more even playing field from the major, major investors that come up and buy out huge buildings and neighborhoods. Because sometimes in the system, the for-profit system, the worst actors rise to the top, as we see in greater, greater monopolization and different things. And we need to build even the playing field for the people that not just want to make a profit, but want to have a business, but also provide quality housing for their tenants and residents of the city.
Ken?
Well, two things. One, you know, we did a study of the problems with lead poisoning in the city of Buffalo. We had access to all of the lead poisoning statistics for about 8 years. And what was interesting about that was that the large properties, the properties that were owned by corporations, were actually better and more compliant with lead rules than were the small ones. So the twos and threes and fours in Buffalo. I'm not saying that that's true here, but the corporate owners in Buffalo, who are kind of getting it in the chin in this conversation, and certainly in Buffalo, were doing a pretty good job of maintaining their apartments. The only way that they managed to keep those lead numbers down is by repainting between tenants, by taking pretty decent care. So it's just not necessarily corporate ones. The one other point I want to make is, remember we started this conversation talking about limiting rents. And if we've got a problem with maintenance, one way to make the problem with maintenance worse is to reduce the amount of money that landlords have to invest in their apartments. So I think we need a more strict enforcement regime. We need to make it easier for tenants to complain about unsafe conditions in a way that does not come back on them. And I think we need to worry about cutting the amount of money landlords have to maintain the property.
I'm way late for a break. Okay. I got to take it, and I'm going to get more perspective. Other landlords sending some notes, phone calls to take. So we're talking about proposals for rent stabilization or rent control in New York State. Could be a statewide proposal and could be adopted by the legislature as soon as next month. You just heard Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Ryan Acuff and Gail Force Williams are members of the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. They're here as well. More of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the legacy of Rachel Held Evans, who died last week suddenly at the age of 37. She had become a leading voice among Christians who were questioning their faith, sometimes challenging their church, but not wanting to leave their faith entirely. It's about the importance of questions, questioning ourselves, what we've learned, what we've been taught, and more. That's next hour. More of your feedback here. Joe writes, as a small-time hands-on landlord in the Beechwood neighborhood where I live, I wanted to express my support for what I view as common sense reform regarding good cause eviction and rent regulation. As it stands now, a tenant of mine could pay rent early every month and be the model tenant in every way for 20 years, and there would be nothing to stop me from ending their tenancy and kicking them out of their home with a 30-day notice. That isn't right. Even with good cause eviction, a landlord would have a convenient workaround without rent regulation, raising the rents in order to force a tenant out. Rent regulation is a way of addressing the power differential between landlords and tenants. That is from Joe. But here is James, who says, Evan, I'm a small-time landlord, and like many landlords in New York, my largest expense is property taxes. Naturally, I pass 100% of that expense onto my tenants in the form of rent. Progressives are not acknowledging that their high tax policies have consequences. If you want to lower rent, just lower the property taxes. Ryan Acuff, what do you say to that?
Well, I do think that most of our programs should be funded through progressive income taxes as opposed to property taxes, which for some people are regressive. But I do think that rents do take that into account, and that rent regulation would take property taxes into account, right? Because that's what it's factored in. What it does is it does rent increases, and that's why there's would be when there with in the cities that do have rent regulation, there's a rent guidelines board that takes property taxes and other building costs into account. So that's all supposed to be built in. So, because, yeah, the tenants are paying the taxes. The tenants are giving all the money for the taxes.
Okay. What do you say, Kent, to the landlord who says, just cut my property taxes and you can cut your rents?
Yeah, well, maybe. I think if you cut the property taxes, it probably would end up being a windfall for the owners. Eventually, that would get capitalized into the value of the property, I suppose. In fact, we did a study
But you wouldn't expect rents to fall.
I wouldn't expect rents to automatically fall. You know, at the same time, costs are costs, and to the extent that we have that we reduce the cost of being a landlord eventually, if there's sufficient supply. But it's, you know, that's the economist's response. It's not that we think that the housing problem doesn't exist. It's just that we think that there's a real problem with supply. You know, again, back to accessory apartments in Rochester. I mean, you know, there's a tremendous potential for new housing in residential neighborhoods in Rochester by allowing accessory apartments. There's a lot we can do. We can build a lot of. I came for the reshaping Rochester luncheon yesterday, and the speaker was talking about what she called the missing middle housing, and these are housing types between single family and multifamily. And you know, there's a lot we can do with duplexes, with triplexes, with fourplex, and again back to accessory apartments. These are relatively we made it easier for people to create accessory apartments. We trained local residents in ways to improve houses. You know, one of my hobby horses has been to come up with a with building codes that are more accessible for people who are in poverty, working with vacant houses. I mean, the building codes sometimes make the cost of renovating, make the cost of creating an accessory apartment just completely unaffordable. If you've got a house that's worth $45,000, $50,000, and you know, bringing it up to code is going to cost you $30,000, you know what's going to happen. That house is eventually going to degrade, and it's going to be condemned and taken down. So there's a lot of things we can do with our existing housing stock.
Well, here's an alternative idea proposed by the economist who studied San Francisco. Diamond and her co-authors suggested the following: a citywide system of government social insurance for renters. Households that see their rents go up could be eligible for tax credits or welfare payments to offset rent hikes, and vouchers to help pay the cost of moving if they have to move. The money for the system would come from taxes on landlords, which would effectively spread the cost among all renters and landowners instead of laying the burden on the vulnerable few. So that comes from the economist who studied San Francisco, who said, don't do rent control, do this. Thoughts from the citywide tenant union on that?
Well, I think one thing is, like we're talking about a number of different solutions, I think we need every tool in the toolbox. And some of the ones we're talking about, I know there's some of the ones where there are pushback from some landlords, some economists, but these, the ones we're talking about in rent control, are really the ones around power. And to be someone that's trying to fix an issue, you need the screwdriver, right? You need the hammer, but you need the power tools, right? We need to have reforms that also change the balance of power, in addition to looking at building codes and stronger code. You know, we need extra rent supplements, extra vouchers, but we also have to even the balance of power. So it's not, you know, we've never said we have a whole platform of reforms, including increasing truly affordable housing, rent supplements, and all of them need to be taken seriously. But we can't just say, okay, just because this upsets a lot of people with a lot of power, right, we can't talk about it. right? And I know that's not, you know, the economist is making some other arguments, but this is what undergirds a lot of this, is the major donors to the political campaigns is the real estate industry, is the largest donor in Albany, right? The Real Estate Board of New York, the Rent Stabilization Association. These are the number one donors. And we need to be able to say, we're going to use the screwdriver, we're going to use the hammer, but we're going to do the power tools, and we're going to have to reset the balance of power. In addition to all of these things, I think we're very open to every single reform that's going to make things more habitable, more conditioned, but we really have to say we're going to use every tool in the toolbox.
Okay, what do you think, Kent?
Oh, I can't disagree. You know, it's, except that a couple of tools I think are perhaps a little bit too damaging. Again, we have to think about long term, not short term. It feels really good to grab some of those power tools and you know, saw the 2x4 in half. But sometimes you kind of need the 2x4 to stay intact. Because long-term benefit, long-term stability, long-term benefit to renters really should be our goal.
Let me get another phone call. Mary, next on the phone. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Ryan. Hi, guys. So I live in the Beachwood neighborhood, and we're seeing rents rising really quickly, like in the last 3 to 5 years, rising 10, 15, even 30% in between tenants without the landlord actually making repairs, and the place is in terrible shape. And so, yes, I hear the code enforcement. But, you know, rent control, from my understanding, it's really going to affect, in our city, the lowest bracket of rents. You know, I have some relationships with landlords that rent at a higher rate. They're not luxury, but their rents are really stable, and they're only able to raise, you know, the market will allow them to raise between 1 and 2%. So I don't see rent control really affecting that bracket of landlord, because they're already, you know, not raising their rents. This is really, you know, I see targeting people that are getting displaced from my neighborhood, who, you know, my next door neighbor was paying $625 for, you know, she had raw sewage in her basement. She moved out. The very next person paid $800, and they didn't fix anything. So I really see this as you know, not really affecting the kind of landlords that, you know, that I know and that I've heard call into the show. I know that there's some concern about regulation and, you know, big government telling people what they can charge. But from my perspective, I really don't see it impacting those kinds of landlords.
Okay.
I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Mary, thank you. I mean, that's the Mary is making the same point Ryan made earlier, and I think that Gail's been making, which is that they believe if you are a landlord that's above board, that is taking care of the tenants and the problems, and that is not overly aggressive in raising the prices for the rent, that this is not going to hurt you, that these policies are not going to hurt you. Do you believe that, Kent?
You know, I think it depends on how the statute is crafted and how the statute is managed. At the end of the day, though, what has historically occurred in places with rent control is it does reduce the confidence that developers have that they'll be able to take a property and redevelop it and actually get, you know, pay off the loan they took out to do the work. So, I mean, again, I still think that the strict rent regulation ultimately has negative consequences. It just takes a while for that to show up.
So, again
if we need to focus on supply.
If you're in the room with lawmakers and they say, then tell me what we can do. Give me that one or two or three things that your ilk thinks that it is going to be effective.
Well, Diamond's suggestions are one set. You know, we can start talking about rent, about vouchers. For heaven's sake, the Section 8 system is completely broken. You know, couldn't we do something to fully fund Section 8? Section 8 would help. Now, you know, you get into the inside workings of Section 8, and some economists would make a credible argument that increases housing demand and in its own way will increase rents. But nonetheless, we've got this system in place. It just doesn't work very well. I mean, the Section 8 waiting lists are just seen in most cities.
All right, so that's at the top. And Gail and Ryan, with about 90 seconds left, some final thoughts from you on what you're going to hope happens in the next month or so with the New York State Legislature. Gail?
Well, I hope everything passed. Due to the fact that, as the young lady called in, it has proven that this is real in Rochester. I'm not sure about Buffalo, but I'm sure there are some things going on. But the bottom line is that what are we really talking about? We're really talking about saving the developers. Those developers are not hurting. So the point is that the smaller guy
really don't even get these big tax breaks. And I know for a fact through research, one building who's a slumlord building, $1.8 million in tax breaks. Why, even homeowners paying this high property tax, paying them to take over, hopefully they'll do the right thing and their rents are out of the cloud, you might want to say. So they need to pass, because we're not talking about the little man that do the right thing.
In 30 seconds, can we learn enough from San Francisco and others, if we do this, not to make those mistakes?
Yes, we can absolutely learn. We can learn how it benefits people that are regulated, and we close the loopholes so people aren't incentivized to take affordable housing off the market.
Okay. You think it's going to happen? You think it's going to pass?
I think there is so much money being thrown in and commercials and by the real estate lobby that it's really, really tough, because it is the most well-funded lobby, and it's going to be a battle, but it's always people versus money.
I want to thank all of our guests for sharing their thoughts. I mean, I'm diagnosing the same problem, different views on how to get there in terms of solutions, and we'll see what the legislature does with the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester, Ryan Acuff and Gail Force Williams. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Kent Gardner, Chief Economist with the Center for Governmental Research. As always, Kent, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Short break. More Connections coming up.